At Cool Air Products, we developed AC Smart Seal Quick Shot with professionals in mind. It's the only product on the market that's 3-in-1, with sealant, lubricant, and UV dye all in a single application. It's non-toxic, non-flammable, 100% safe to the touch, eco-friendly, and compatible with all refrigerants. It's a safe solution option, backed by years of R&D, Intertech tested, and has sealed millions of leaks. AC Smart Seal, the professional's choice.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the podcast. So we're going to talk duct design, duct sizing, and some considerations to think about when you're designing and sizing up ductwork. So we got John Stischak from Armstrong Fluid Technology on with us, and he's going to go and take this bit of a deep dive with us into duct design and duct sizing. This is the HVAC Know-It-All Podcast, guys. I'm your host, Gary McCready. This podcast is sponsored by Master, and we talked about the A2L tanks having left-handed threads coming your way real soon if you haven't experienced this already. So Yellow Jacket has got the hose, the charging hose, and the charging hose adapter that you're going to need attached to attach to these tanks. So there's a big giant wall at Master with Yellow Jacket stuff. If it's not on that wall, talk to your local Master rep and ask them to bring it in, because you're going to need these eventually to hook up to A2L tanks. This podcast is sponsored by Cintas. They are major players in the blue collar uniform game. So if you're looking to outfit your team with some blue collar uniforms, shirts, pants, jackets, vests, hoodies, whatever it is, hats, check out cintas.com/HVAC Know-It-All.
Welcome to the HVAC Know-It-All Podcast. Recorded from a basement somewhere in Toronto, Canada, your host and HVAC tech, Gary McCready, will take you on a deep dive into the industry, discussing all things HVAC. From storytelling to technical discussion. Enjoy the show.
Welcome back, John. How you been, man?
Been doing very well. Appreciate you having me back.
Yeah, man. It's always great talking to you. We've done some really in-depth conversations on humidity, dehumidification in the past, and we're going to have a bit of a different conversation this time, and it pertains to ductwork and maybe some design considerations and stuff like that. So, I mean, we were just talking off air, I guess, even though we're not a radio show, but we were just talking before I hit record. And one of the cool things, and we'll get to this later because we don't want to start confusing people, because I've never heard of this term, right? But later on, just so the audience is aware, we're going to talk about a term called static regain, and it's a way to design ductwork and stuff like that. I've never heard of it, and you can explain it later on after we get through some basic stuff. So, I mean, how do you want to start this off? Because we want to try to keep this. I'm sure there's people listening that have designed ducts before and have their way of doing it. But how do you want to start this off? Just so we can keep it basic, so everybody can get a kind of an understanding of what we're doing here.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the way to look at duct design is there are really good manuals out there by SMACNA and the Insulation Institutes that will kind of show you how to construct the ductwork, right? So we have a really good cookbook on how to put together ductwork and how to make fittings and kind of what fittings to use where. And our job as a duct designer is really coming down to just sizing the duct. And, you know, there's a couple of things that come into play when you're looking at that. First off is the number, you know, the air volume you have to deliver, which we typically do in cubic feet per minute. And that's going to translate to a velocity in that ductwork for the size of the duct. You know, a smaller duct is going to have higher velocity. A larger duct is going to have lower velocity. If you're running lower velocities, you're going to have less static loss per 100 feet or per foot, and you're going to have lower noise. So that's kind of like the basic kind of just to set the groundwork of, you know, if you're having a high static loss issue on a duct system, it's probably because you're trying to move too much velocity, too much cubic feet of air through a given air surface air, given volume of ductwork. So if you increase that area of the cross-sectional area of the ductwork, you can get the velocity down, you can get the static pressure loss per unit length of duct down. So that's kind of like the groundwork there. And, you know, when you think about moving air through duct, it's not really any different than moving air through a piping system or moving water through a piping system. It's just the units and the quantity of pressures we're dealing with are much lower. So mm-hmm. a typical residential duct system might work on 1 inch of total static versus, a commercial system may have 2 or 3 inches of static if you're doing like VAVs or something like that. So those are kind of some of the general things to kind of set some groundwork there.
Okay, and I mean, like, before we, you said we're going to send some CFM through maybe a duct system to a room, and I think it's important yep. that we do, if we're going to start a duct design, we should probably do a load calculation to find out how much load yep. each room needs first, you know what I mean? Or how, yep, how that, much that. load is put on each room first?
Yep, that's kind of your starting point to figure out what quantity of air you need. You're looking at your room loads, and you really need to do a room by room load to really dial it in. I mean, you can do a block load for a small house and kind of make some estimates based on square footage, and okay, we know that room's got some larger windows, but to really nail it down and get a tighter calculation, you're going to do a room by room cooling load, and then you're going to look at your difference in BTUs in your supply air versus how many BTUs you need to absorb in that space, and you're going to need to deliver that quantity of air. And there's a bunch of software programs that'll calculate all that out for you. If you've got 55 degree air, it'll okay, if I'm trying to keep 75 degrees and 50% humidity, it'll give you values for how much energy you'll absorb for every CFM put into that room to get it back to 75 and 50. So that's a good starting point, right? So we need, for example, we have a room that we know, needs 100 CFM in it. We would just grab our duct calculator, and the easiest way to figure out kind of where we're going to be at with a duct size is just to use an equal friction loss method. So each section of duct work for the given CFM it's supposed to handle is going to have the same friction loss per 100 feet of duct. So if I just go and I say I want 100 CFM, I'll set the duct calculator at 0.08 or 0.1. A lot of times residential you use 0.08 inches of water column per 100 feet. That's just a good rule of thumb. And I know sometimes people don't like sticking with the rules of thumb, but it's really a simple way to get at least a baseline without having to get into really in-depth calculations if you don't have a software that's helping you out with it. Yep. So that's showing me a 6-inch sheet metal duct. And if I go to a duct board calculator, a flexible calculator, and I set that same CFM up at the same friction loss, we're looking at, it's giving me 7 inches. So you'll probably have to go to an 8 because they may not have 7-inch flex available. And actually, an 8 works out better because this one actually gives you at 4% compression and 15% compression. So when you're installing that flexible duct, do you think you ever get it stretched out to only 4% compression, or do you think there's some slack in that?
It's I don't really do much duct install at all, but yeah, yeah. I do understand that stretching that stuff out and running it as straight as possible is probably the best way to go, right?
It really is critical. There's a group called the Air Distribution Institute that did a lot of study on this, and actually that's where this duct calculator came from. If you have 30% compression in that same run of flex versus only having 4% compression, you're clear up to a 9-inch diameter required to carry the same amount of air at the same friction loss. If you think about it, as you stretch that flexible duct out, the interior is getting smoother. It's just like a slinky in there,
yeah,
pretty much.
The tighter that
slinky stretched out, the tighter the material stretched out, the less corrugation you have on the inside of that duct. So that's one thing to really think about, because a lot of people in the north run sheet metal all the way out to the register boots. That's a lower friction loss system than if we ran a 6-inch piece of flex. So there might be a tight spot to get through and you're going to run flex for, 10 feet. You need to consider there's going to be a little bit more pressure loss there than, if it was able to be a nice straight sheet metal run.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you this. I agree. Not everybody likes rules of thumbs, but what you're saying is just giving us a ballpark of where we can go. And you said like in residential, a lot of times we use the number of 0.8 on the duct calculator, right?
0.08.
Sorry, 0.08. So what I was going to ask you is, let's say we're landing sort of on a duct size that's kind of in like we get to a size and we're like, okay, that seems small. Maybe I should go and upsize it a little bit. So here's the two questions I'm gonna or pose or the comments I'm gonna make to that. So obviously upsizing the duct is gonna cost more, mm-hmm. right? Because it's a bigger piece of yep. metal. It's gonna cost more money. So I'm hoping that contractors and designers aren't looking at that and going, okay, I'm gonna go with the smaller size just to save on costs. But wouldn't it just be better to upsize a little bit? Because you have the advantage of using dampers and balancing out the system when you're upsized rather than having it too small, because then you can't balance at all if it's too small, because you got nothing to balance it. The system's already too small as it is. Right?
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, look at it on a case by case basis too, to some degree. Like that particular example, we were at 500 feet per minute on the velocity. So like I would feel comfortable delivering that to, you know, a bedroom, a living area, someplace where it's going to be quiet. If you get a duct size and you're starting to creep up in velocity at the pressure loss, right? So we're at 0.1 or 0.08, but my velocity is 1500 or 1600 or 1700 feet per minute. You may want to set a limiting factor and use velocity as your secondary limit to say, okay, no, I want to upsize that duct. I want to get down to 1,000 feet per minute because it's a house or an auditorium or someplace that, you know, noise is critical. So even in my supply trunk, maybe I want to keep it under 1,000 feet per minute there. So I might not use, you know, 0.1. I may start there and then go, oof, my velocity is too high. I don't like that velocity. Let me upsize that and just drop my velocity down to where I want it to be. So that's a good point. You know, it's something to consider. Most smaller residential systems, you know, when you're dealing with, you know, ducts that are under 2000 CFM, you know, relatively smaller, you're going to end up just by using 0.08 to 0.1 down under 1000 feet per minute. So noise isn't really going to be an issue there. So okay. It is an extra cost to upsize that duct, but certain applications definitely warrant it.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. Now if you get online and you start talking about airflow and humidity and dehumidification and all that stuff, and 400 CFM per ton as a rule of thumb. But what I want to ask you here is, I think you need to know what you want to accomplish with your, like, an air conditioning system, for example, because if we want to humidify, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but this is from everything I've learned, this is sort of the rules of thumb that we're going to use. If we want to dehumidify the space, if we live in a very humid climate, we want to lower that CFM per ton, right? And if we're in a drier area and we're more worried about sensible cooling, like dropping the temp, we can raise that CFM per ton up a little bit, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because what you're doing effectively by raising and lowering that CFM is you're playing with your discharge air temperature, right? So if I'm not doing as much latent cooling, I can do more sensible cooling. The tons are the tons. It's a 5-ton unit, let's say. It's going to do 5 tons, providing we give it enough air to not freeze the coil. You should get roughly 5 tons out of it, give or take. I mean, it's really going to be closer to 4.5. And as you slide that airflow around, you may lose a little bit because maybe it's not as efficient in latent cooling as it is in sensible cooling. But in end of the day, the total tons are going to be close to the total tons. So if you lower that airflow, like in Florida, we were down to using 350, 325 CFM per ton because we needed that dehumidification.
Yeah.
And that gave us a little bit lower discharge air temperature. So it's the cost effective to build thinner, cheaper coils that didn't have as much coil thickness to really get that air temperature down, we could still get a low enough air temperature to pull the moisture out, right? So, and if we had a cooling problem, but our, you know, temperature, a sensible temperature problem, but our humidity was fine in the space, maybe we would bump that fan speed up and try to get more air over that coil and get a little bit more sensible capacity out of that unit to dry that air out a little bit better.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and,
cool.
You know, when you're looking at a duct system and you're trying to figure out what CFM I need to base this duct system around, that is an important point. Where are we basing our airflow? Is it we basing it 400 CFM per ton or 350 CFM per ton? And then what is my fan static pressure capable? You know, on a lot of residential units, especially the more cost effective ones, you might be down to only having 0.6 or 0.8 inches of static pressure at high fan speed. That may be all that fan can give you at the airflow that you want. So you need to look mm-hmm. at those manufacturer printed fan curves and go, okay, I only have, you know, a half inch of static to work with. I need to be really careful because I know that if I put a media filter on this thing, at the unit, I'm going to burn up maybe a quarter inch already. Yeah. So my return needs to be extremely efficient. I might only have, you know, 0.1 inches or 0.2 inches of total static loss available on my return. And now I've only got, you know, a quarter inch on my supply that I have left before I run out of static pressure on that unit and I start going lower airflow than what I want. So that's an important concern. You know, a lot of the new ECM air handlers and residential can go up to an inch of static.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you have to remember too that fans are kind of like pumps. When you have a low net positive suction head available on a pump, you'll cavitate the pump. Well, when you have high return static, so, you know, will be very low, I guess, a large negative number on that return static. So if you're pulling, you know, 0.8 inch negative because you've got this MERV 14 filter that's only a 1-inch filter right at the unit, and that will actually start stalling that fan. You'll start losing performance on that fan. It's not designed to work under that much negative static pressure, and then you can't get any air out of the unit, even though total static's only at 1 inch. Oh, okay, it can handle 1 inch. Well, it really needs to be close to balanced or more on the supply side, because fans like to pump in the duct and not have a large static negative to pull on the inlet side.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I'm glad you brought up media filter, and I'm glad you said ECM, because I got a couple points there to make, because there's a lot of misconception on media filters. And if we go, if we keep things all equal as far as MERV goes,
anything from helper to skilled trades worker to a managerial type level person, I mean, if you're having trouble finding these people to work within your business, if you haven't tried wisehire.com, please check them out, because that's what they've been designed to do. Their CEO, man, this guy is energetic when it comes to this subject. He's been on the podcast. So if you're having trouble and you haven't tried wisehire.com, check them out, guys. So Chirp is a platform that's deeply integrated into all the major CRM tools. And its purpose and its ability is to stay in touch with your customer base through the year using automated campaigns. Those campaigns could be set up for whatever you like. Follow up on quotes, follow up on recommendations you've made to customers about certain things, right? Remind them it's time to change their filter. Remind them it's time for their maintenance. Those types of things that can get kind of lost in the shuffle as you're busy. So check out chirp.com. Navac has come out with a line of tubing tools over the last couple of years, and they're phenomenal. And if you guys have them and use them, you'll know what I mean. The tubing expander, the bender, and the flaring tool, all battery powered, and they're all excellent tools for installs. If you're doing VRF, if you're doing mini splits, if you're doing residential stuff, they all come in very handy. And when I'm doing install, these tools are literally set up and ready to go, batteries plugged in, because they're my favorites and my go-tos, guys. So check out Navac's lineup of tubing tools.
There are some that will still battle you on saying that a 5-inch filter is going to cause more restriction than a 1-inch filter, just because they think it's thicker and it's going to be harder for the air to get through it. But it's really not thicker. It's just a deeper pleat. The media, if we keep the MERV rating, like I said, the same across the 1-inch compared to the 5-inch, we just have deeper pleats. The media is the exact same thickness that we're trying to get through. But if we can cut the media out of that 5-inch filter and spread it out on the floor, the surface area is going to be way more than the surface area of a 1-inch filter. So that's why it's always a good idea, if you are having some issues with your return static, maybe increasing your return drop and putting in a 5-inch media filter. And I've seen that bring the return static down quite a bit just by doing those two things.
Definitely, especially if the homeowner or client is using like a very restrictive MERV 14 1-inch filter. If you stretch that media out and look at the surface area difference versus the surface area of a 5-inch filter, it's going to be huge. And it is basically the same restriction on the media, and it has the same effect as, you know, putting in a larger duct. If you think about it, the passages, the total volume of passages in that 1-inch filter versus the total surface area of passages in your 5-inch filter, you're going to have more surface area. You're going to be slowing that air down to a lower velocity to get through that media, and that's where your static loss is greatly reduced, because you have all this, you know, surface area to get through.
Yeah.
So yeah, 5-inch filters are great.
Yeah, perfect. I'm glad we agree on that, and I just hope that, because anytime I do a switch out of something, like in a residential, I always say, listen, trust me when I say this, I'm not trying to upsell you something that you don't need, but your system is going to perform much better with a 5-inch media filter. It's going to get more particulate. You're going to have less airflow restriction and probably less chronic issues with your system over time. So I always recommend them. And the other thing point I wanted to make, because you brought up ECM, is I was talking to, this is going back a couple of years now, Bob Toner, who's a friend and industry, been in the industry for a long time, especially on the electronic side of things. And we had a conversation about ECM motors and why they fail so rapidly, especially if the system ductwork is designed poorly. And the way he explained it to me is, listen, it has onboard electronics. You need air movement to keep those electronics cool. So if your duct system is kind of like restricted and you don't have that proper airflow, you have high like return static, like you were saying, we're not getting the proper air movement by that electronic board on that ECM. And heat is a killer for electronic parts. So do you have anything to say on that particular subject?
Yeah, definitely. So if you're having a restricted duct system and you're at close to the limits of what that ECM is able to produce, you're also going to be at the highest amp draw that that ECM is going to ever run at. If you have a less restricted duct system, it's going to try to deliver, let's say it's set for 2000 CFM on a 5-ton unit. It's going to try to deliver 2000 CFM. If it's doing that under a lower load, it's not going to sit there and just run at max amp and over speed. It's going to sit there and deliver 2000 CFM or approximately at a less amp draw. So it's going to run cooler. It's going to get the cooling airflow it needs, and it's going to be a pretty happy motor. If you're down around 1850 CFM and it's set for 2000, it's trying to get there and it can't get there, and it's just running at max amp load, now you've got much more heat being generated by that motor. You're not getting the same amount of cooling airflow over that motor, and so you're just putting that motor at an extreme disadvantage. You've got more heat being generated, you've got less cooling airflow, and it's just going to sit there, run hotter, and you will absolutely reduce the lifespan of that motor doing that.
Perfect. Glad to hear it. Okay, so fittings. You talked about stretching out corrugated duct or flexible duct. How important are the fittings? Because, I mean, we can have a fitting that's square compared to a rounded edge on a 90, turning vanes inside. All these things matter, right, when it comes to restriction of the duct system.
Definitely. I mean, obviously, your lowest loss is going to be radius for everything, you know, using the typical radiuses. I think was it... it's a 1.5 radius, I think, on the center line is a good place to start. And if you're using square duct, you know, if you run, round duct's going to be your least surface area for the same volume. Then square duct's going to be your next most efficient. And as you go more and more rectangular, you're having more and more surface area, so you're going to use more and more sheet metal. So if you're trying to save on sheet metal cost, you know, if you can fit round in there, that's better off. And then you can use sweeping round 90s or even the five, you know, the adjustable 90s aren't bad. When you have a square 90 without turning vanes, you know, you're basically taking that velocity pressure that the stand fan creates, because it's going to create static pressure and velocity pressure. You're basically throwing away that velocity pressure only using the fan static pressure. You're going to hit the end of that 90 and have a whole bunch of static loss. Whole bunch of velocity loss, and then have a whole bunch of static, you know, created right there at that 90, and you're going to have a lot more losses versus you have a sweeping 90. And kind of the same thing goes with takeoffs. If you need to do a smooth takeoff, you know, you can typically, you know, you'll run a square trunk line, you'll just tap round into the side of it, and that works for, you know, most residential applications pretty well. But, you know, if you have a VAV system that's running higher velocities and higher pressures, you might want to use a conical takeoff to get a little bit more surface area at that opening to reduce your static loss at that opening, get more airflow down that run out. Mm-hmm. Kind of the same thing goes, you know, with return. A lot of people ignore return. And really, when you think about a return system versus supply system, the air doesn't know which way it's going when it hits a 90 degree turn, right? So one of the things that can be done to, you know, make it a little bit easier to run the return duct is sometimes you'll use, you know, 80% of the velocity that you're using in the supply, or you use 80% of your static loss. So if you're using 0.1 for supply, you'll use 0.8 for return. for your inches of water gauge per 100 feet. And, you know, that allows you to have maybe a little bit more, I guess, abrupt turns in your return. But, you know, like I said, the air doesn't know which way it's going. So if you're really concerned about static loss on the return side, if you're using radiuses there too, that's much, much better. You know, if you're tapping into it, you can tap into it with a lateral 45 degree connection instead of a 90 degree connection to improve your static loss at those connections. So it all adds up. It's all additive. If you have very restrictive grills and then a not very restrictive duct system, you know, you can probably get away with that versus if you have restrictive grills, a restrictive duct system, a restrictive filter, and it all compounds on itself. So it's kind of a whole system approach. And you got to start thinking, okay, what is my goal with this air? Do I need to throw it clear across the warehouse with a big drum diffuser? Do I need high velocity and clean airflow at that diffuser? Or am I trying to get it to trickle into a bedroom and not even be noticed when it goes into that room?
Yeah. Yeah, you did bring up grills. And how important is the selection of a grill? Because, I mean, especially people that are interested in the decor of their home, they might go out to Home Depot or something and go, oh, that's a pretty grill and stick it on all over the house. Right. But not really knowing exactly what it's going to do to the duct system, to the airflow, to the system performance.
Exactly.
Is this something that is like, it doesn't really matter that much, or is it super important to consider this?
It a little bit depends on your actual distribution system. Like, you know, up in the north here that I've learned to become accustomed to, a lot of times we've got floor registers, right?
Yep.
And we're delivering the air at a little bit lower velocity in the wintertime. We happen to be lucky enough to have a two-speed air handler and a multi-stage furnace. So the air kind of trickles out and kind of blends, and it's not as big of a deal perhaps in that system as, you know, if you're trying to throw the air across the living room. If you have a very restrictive stamped grill, one, you're going to have higher static pressure losses. It's going to be noisier, but you're not going to get the air distribution out of that grill. You know, that you're going to lose all of that velocity at that grill. You're just going to just have that air dumping out and not getting to the spaces it needs and not mixing thoroughly. I'm definitely a big proponent of, you know, actual bladed diffusers. If you're doing ceiling diffusers, if you're doing floor registers, getting ones that are not very restrictive and the ones that, you know, are going to actually give some direction to the airflow, versus if you get, you know, a really nice decorative, you know, wrought iron cutout grill, it's going to let that air just kind of pour out of there, and it's not going to throw it across the room like you'd want it to.
Yeah. Just off topic, there is a video I seen. I can't remember on what it went through a bunch of different platforms because it seemed to be a popular video. I think it was Round Duck, and the Round Duck was feeding these fans, like just air circulation fans at the top. But mm-hmm. also the fans had these like grooves or holes in them, and it was also the diffuser. So the fan was spinning.
Oh, that's pretty neat.
It was diffusing the air, right? But it was also mm-hmm. spinning, I guess, to push the air downwards as well.
To create like a cone of air that expanded and washed over a large area. That's a pretty cool design.
I mean, I'm sure if you look it up online, you type in just Google like fan diffuser or something like that. It was pretty cool, and it went around and everybody's like, wow, this is cool, because I've never seen it before.
The other thing you look at, just one more thing on diffusers, real quick. Most diffusers that are going to have higher performances, they'll give you performance criteria. So it'll give you your available throw at a given airflow and velocity, and it'll give you a noise criteria. If you're looking at like a stamped diffuser, you're probably not going to get any of that data. But if you go to any of the major manufacturers and you're looking for a more expensive diffuser that's actually has manufactured blades in it that are, you know, like adjustable blades or even fixed blade, but it's just not a stamped, you know, bargain basement diffuser, you can get more performance data out of it, and then that'll actually show you what you can expect from that diffuser, what kind of airflow you can get if you, you know, put it on the ceiling and have this static pressure behind it. So it's really better to look at that if you can, for sure.
Okay. And when you say stamped diffuser, can you just give a definition of what you mean by that?
Yeah, so
you
see them like in Home Depot. It's made out of a single piece of sheet metal with louvers stamped in it. I'm actually staring up at the ceiling of one right now. A lot of times they won't have any kind of damper behind them, or if they do, it's just like a parallel blade damper with a little side lever on it. They're pretty common in a lot of applications. Floor diffusers a lot of times will be a heavier stamped sheet metal diffuser with louvers stamped into it versus something that has separate vanes that are on either control rods for like a ceiling mounted one or for a floor mounted one. It may be extruded bars that have a specific angle to them, like a grill that's what would you call that, like a bar diffuser that you see in like okay. in a commercial application.
Gotcha. No, I think I understand what you mean. Yeah. Okay, so at the beginning of the podcast we talked about a certain phrase, static regain. So yep. maybe we can talk about, just tell us what static regain is and how folks are designing duct systems using this term.
All right, definitely. So static regain is basically a sizing methodology that is utilizing the velocity pressure that was imparted to the moving airstream to, when you slow that velocity down, you're regaining some static pressure. And it all comes back to trading energy back and forth, right? You can't create or destroy energy. So if I've put velocity into something and I slow that air down, that energy is still there. The energy didn't go away. It's just dissipated in the form of static pressure. And it's a little bit more accurate duct sizing system or methodology. Typically, when it's done by a computer-aided design software of some sort. And you're not typically going to do a static regain calculation by hand. You can. It's just not any fun. If you're using the equal friction method, where you're just using your duct calculator and using, you know, 0.08 inches of water gauge or 0.1 inches of water gauge per 100 feet, you're going to have close to the same result until you get into, you know, very much larger systems at very high velocities. That's where that's going to start to matter a little bit more. And so it's just another methodology, and it's using the energy in the air and taking into account that velocity.
Interesting. Yeah, so I'd have to do a little bit more research on that myself because it seems like in depth, but at the same time, I think if you understand the basic principles of static pressure and velocity and CFM and all that, you could probably pick up on what static regain is, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, it's just for most calculations, unless it's being done by a computer, it's not really. The benefits are outweighed by the drawbacks if you're doing it by hand for most systems.
Okay. All right. Now, I guess we'll get going in a minute here, but I was going to ask you about duckboard as well, because I'm going to presume like this conversation, as we were discussing, we're talking about sheet metal ducts and that is, and this is, this sounds like a silly question, might sound like a silly question to some, but I don't deal with duckboard. Is there a separate duct calculator for duckboard than sheet metal, or is it just the same?
There is actually one calculator I've seen that does have duckboard on it. And the
numbers are different a little bit?
A little bit. And it's because of the surface roughness of the inside of a piece of duckboard. If you think about sheet metal, it's assumed to be a smooth, flat, clean surface. Duckboard, by its very nature, is a porous or semi-porous surface. Now, there's ones that are sealed with a black antimicrobial surface, but it's just not as smooth for the air to go through, so there's going to be a little bit more friction loss. It's not drastic. It's not huge, and for most residential and small systems you use duckboard for, it's really not that big a deal. The market I came from down in Florida, almost every residential system was duckboard. And they would run a what we call an extended plenum. So then maybe they take two sections of duckboard, so 8 feet. And if it's a vertical unit in a closet, they'd go up 8 feet. That'd poke them into the attic 3 or 4 feet. And then they would spider out from there with maybe up to 4 or 5 runouts and go to a large oversized triangle and then have up to 5 runouts out of that triangle.
Yeah.
So in a house that may have, you know, 20 diffusers, there may be, you know, I don't know, 5 triangles and, you know, 5 runouts. And if you size it that way, even sizing with equal friction, you're going to do okay, probably. Where it gets into, where you can get into trouble is if you run from triangle to triangle. So if you go off the plenum with a piece of flex, stretch it out, hit a triangle, then go from there and hit another triangle, that's a much more difficult system to lay out.
Yeah.
So, but you guys probably don't even see that hardly up in the north.
No,
but that was huge down in South Florida.
No, I up here, I've never seen one of those big spiders anywhere.
Yeah, that's so, almost every home down in South Florida is run that way.
Interesting. So why in Florida are we using duckboard? Like what is the purpose of that?
I think it may have started out from, the north is where a lot of the trades always were. You had unions, you had journeymen that were taught by senior people and they taught apprentices, and the skill of sheet metal is a learned skill. And in South Florida, I think, and maybe initially, that base didn't really exist as well. And duckboard is easier to run. It's easier to run in the field. You know, anyone can cut it with a knife. And it is a skill to put together. Just like if you ever watched an insulator work on a piece of duct, and then you try to do the same thing, if you're not an insulator, you're going to have a rough time.
Yeah.
Those guys develop a skill with insulation. Same thing down south. There are guys that run duckboard that are artists with it. I mean, they can cut, radius 90s out of it. They can build all kind of stuff. And that seems to be the skill set that evolved down there for whatever reason. So that's what people know how to work with predominantly, unless you get to your big sheet metal shops. Of course, there's guys down there that can do it. But in residences, it's more cost effective. The spaces too, because you think about up north, almost everyone had a basement. So running sheet metal in a basement, that's easy. You got the floor joist to run in. You can pan off floor joists for return. It makes life pretty easy. You've got all floor registers for the most part. Up there, or down there in Florida, you're mainly running ceiling diffusers, and you're putting ceiling diffusers kind of back towards the entryway of the room, and your returns, mm-hmm. if you put them in individual rooms, you want to get them out over the windows because you're trying to pull the heat off the windows. So how do you get into the very edge of a truss system with sheet metal? It would be almost impossible, and it'd be 90s forever because the trusses don't all line up, like floor joists do as easily. So it's easier to run a register boot and then flex back to a box and then flex back because it's quicker, it's easier, it's more cost effective. And that's kind of the crux of it, is the different type of construction led to a different material being easier to work in the field and build in the field. And I think that's where we ended up at.
Yeah, that's an interesting take on it. One that I've never heard. I've always wondered why down in Florida that they use duckboard.
Right, a higher humidity environment, right?
And yeah.
And if it's put together properly and you seal it properly and it's built correctly, I mean, it still will last, 20, 30 years, as long as no one's tramples on it. If you have someone go through the attic and run a cable line for you and they step on the ductwork, well, you're going to have a bad time. For sheet metal, they're probably not going to damage it as easily.
Yeah, I want to tell everybody about, I just wanted to see if it was still on my phone. I barely use it because I don't do any of this, but there's a cool app called Duct. It's actually called Duct, and it's a paid for app. I think I can't remember how much I paid for it. It was less than $20, but it's on my phone forever, and it's a digital ductulator. It's very cool, actually. I don't know if you can. No, that's too bright for you to see there, but I mean. It's a very cool. It's got like when you scroll, like your all of your round duct diameter, your air volume, your velocity, everything's scrolling together. Just like as you turn a ductulator, everything's lining up. So as you scroll one thing, everything else scrolls with it to line everything up where it needs to be. So it's a pretty cool little app. I wish I had a chance to use it more, but I don't really get into any sort of duct design myself.
Yep, I actually have a similar one. Just called Ductulator from East Coast Design to Fabrication. I think I paid $4 for it or something. And it actually looks like the wheel Ductulator. Because sometimes I think you can get a better visual when you see things on a kind of a graphical form like the duck wheel than you can when you're just looking at it in numbers. And that's the same thing why I keep the Bell & Gossett little piping system sizer wheel around, because even though there's phone apps for it, sometimes it's easier to pick it up, look at it visually, see, touch, just a quicker reference for me than just seeing numbers in a grid.
I gotcha. Okay. So one last question and then I'll let you head out. How important is sealing of a duct, first of all? And there's different ways to do it. People in my area, like you never in residential, you never see mastic painted on ever. It's all foil tape. It's all like tin tape. So there's the tape, there's mastic, and now there's these products where you can spray on the inside and it seals everything from the inside, all your penetrations and infiltrations in your duct system. So one, how important is sealing the duct so you're not losing that treated air to place in the wall or in the floor or wherever? And what do you think about methodology of sealing? What would your choice be?
That's actually a really good question. It's going to be a little bit of a multifaceted answer, but first I'll say it depends, which, you know, that's always great. But, you know, if you're, let's say you're dealing with a standard supply system in a residence in a basement, then it's a sealed basement. If you have some duct leakage there of supply duct, that's not really that major because it's still going to end up inside the building envelope, right?
Yeah.
And if anything, if the basement really isn't used and there's no air conditioning really dedicated to the basement, it may percolate a little bit of warm air down there in the winter, and it'll kind of preheat that area a little bit. It'll cool that area a little bit in the summertime. So not great to have duct leakage. You really never really want duct leakage, but it's less critical in that scenario than, let's say, we're in South Florida and the attic's vented and it's 104 degrees in the attic and I'm sucking in 104 degree air into my return, putting that extra load of moisture and sensible energy on my coil, and then I'm leaking it out into the attic on the other side, on the supply side. So, you know, in a northern environment where you're inside the building envelope, you know, taping it is typically sufficient. I mean, you really need to look at your codes and standards to see what is required. That's going to be your first checkbox. You know, like in South Florida, they required a mechanical means of sealing it, and then you could mastic after that. So like tape counted in most places. When you were putting together a ductboard, you had to staple it and tape it, right? So for me personally, once again, it kind of depends on the application, but I like to see mastic on sheet metal. It lasts forever. It's sealed. If you're in a very humid environment, though, the problem with the mastic, it can provide a spot for dust and dirt to grab onto, then a spot for microbial growth if you have a lot of condensation on that duct, like if you have uninsulated duct or poorly insulated duct in an attic. So it really depends on your pressure class, what air you're handling. Are you handling exhaust? Are you handling noxious exhaust? Are you handling biological exhaust, like out of a hospital lab? You know, the seal requirements for that are going to be much higher than it is for a residential duct system. Like if you put spiral in a large, you know, furniture store and you've got just supply outlets cut into the side of the spiral, that being sealed well is only critical so you don't get like that dirt streaking on there from, you know, air passing over and then dirt sticking to that area from the, from the, you know, static electricity created, or, you know, velocity sucking air into there. Or sucking dirt into that area. That's the only reason that sealing is critical there, because you're dumping the air into that space anyways, right? Mm-hmm. So it just depends on the duct system. Like if it's under negative pressure and it's a noxious exhaust, if you do have leakage, at least it'll be leaking into the duct. But, you know, if you have a positively pressurized duct that's got, you know, noxious exhaust in it at that point, that sealing on that's going to be much, much more critical, because you want that basically liquid tight at that point. You know, like kitchen duct, for example, that all has to be liquid tight because of the grease. You don't want the grease leaking out of that duct and then potentially creating a fire hazard and damaging the insulation, right?
It's all welded here. All kitchen exhaust duct, it's all welded. Yeah.
Well, except for residential, right? I mean, if you have a little
restaurant. Well, yeah. A commercial restaurant, you'll never see it's around here. You'll never see a commercial restaurant duct that's not welded on the exhaust side. So
unless you have the clamp together duct. But...
Oh, yeah, true. That's also true. Yeah. But from my experience, when I'm driving by an old restaurant and you hear those old greasy exhaust fans up on the roof,
the old utility sets on the roof. Yep.
Yeah. It's all welded stuff. Yeah. So what's your thoughts on the, I can't remember the name of it. Aero Seal or something like that.
Oh, Aero Seal. That is one of the brands that does it. It makes sense if you have an old duct system in a commercial building where the cost to set up and the cost to seal it is not cost prohibitive. So like for a residence, you know, if you're doing duct sealing in a residence, it would have to be a really large residence or have some really expensive wall finishings to justify that type of ceiling. I mean, it doesn't make sense because the cost to set up is just huge. But if you have like a historic building or something where we really can't get to all this ductwork, but we know we have a huge duct leakage problem and we're trying to improve that, and so we don't want to cut open ceilings and walls because it's just, you know, too much to replace those finishes, and it's, you know, we're trying to preserve it as it is, then that actually can make really good sense. Where like if you have a ductboard system in a residence, you know, cleaning that system may not even make that much sense because you can do more damage by trying to clean it than just, you know, either sealing over it, which is probably cost prohibitive, or in most cases it's best just to replace it.
Cool.
But yeah, AeroSeal is pretty cool. It's a neat product for the right application if the cost is justifiable.
And I mean, I don't even want to open up the can of worms on duct sealing because it's such a polarizing topic, and I actually want to get a did I say duct cleaning? What did I say, duct sealing or duct cleaning?
You said sealing, but I think you meant cleaning.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I meant to say duct cleaning because it's such a can of worms, and anytime the topic comes up online, it's very polarizing because people say like if you clean the ducts, you can stir up more particulate and create a health hazard for the home. But if you got a bunch of duct leak, for instance, listen, I can see my duct system down in my basement right now, and I know the way my kids operate, and I know they jump around. You can see the floorboard shake, right? So it's also shaking the exhaust. So I'm thinking if there's any dirt kind of stuck to the return duct in my home, and my kids are jumping on the floor, and the ducts are also moving as the floor moves, it's got to be like disturbing some of that dust or buildup that's in there, right? I don't know, man. It's just I don't want to open up that can of worms right now. But you can give me a quick thought on it right now before we head out.
For the most part, don't try to clean a ductboard system. Don't try to clean a system that's lined. It's that you're just going to end up tearing it up most likely. There's not many effective ways I've seen of cleaning those systems. Sheet metal, of course, it's much more robust, so you can clean it. Doesn't need to be cleaned. I think it's going to come down to your application. You know, why are you considering cleaning it? Is it because it's 30 years old and you're just worried about the dust and you're not having any, you know, issues? Or is someone identified, oh, wow, you've got something going on. There's something, you know, microbial growth or whatever in the, granted, take that with a grain of salt too. You really have to get an expert that you trust to look at that. But, you know, they identify, hey, there's a problem. You've had a moisture. Let's say you've had a roof leak and there's water that got into the ducts, or your basement flooded and there's water that got in the ducts. Okay, those ducts need to have something done. They need to be replaced or cleaned or something, right? If you've got, you know, something like that going on. So it's going to depend. It's going to be a system by system basis. It's there's no one right answer unless you have ductboard, in which case probably don't clean it.
But, okay, cool. All right. Okay, yeah. Well, we'll open up a whole
that could be a whole nother podcast. Yeah.
Oh, that could be a 2-hour podcast on duct cleaning getting a proponent and an opponent of the thing, and just have a discussion. Anyway, all right, John, I gotta head out because I gotta start up a heater that I'm being sent on. So you have an awesome day, and I'll talk to you on the next one, man. I appreciate your time today.
Yeah. Yeah, you as well. Hopefully we were able to answer some questions and get to some good topics. I'm sure there's still another hour or three we could go on duct design alone. So if we want to come back, talk about it more, you know, if you've got people come questions, you know, I'm happy to answer questions and help out. So,
okay. And I will say this, it's a 5-part series. And if you look it up, Allison Bales, who is like, has his own design firm. I believe he's got his own design firm. He's been on the podcast and we talked duct design. He's got a 5-part series on his blog about duct design, and it's actually really good. It's
that's
a really
awesome.
Good read.
Yeah,
yeah, it's a really good read. If you Google it, Allison Bale, Energy Vanguard, I believe is the name of his company, the blog. And if you try to Google Allison Bale's Energy Vanguard 5-part series on duct design, I think everybody could get a little bit of knowledge out of it. So.
Definitely. Yeah, that's good.
Awesome. Cool. All right, John, thank you very much.
Excellent.
Man.
This conversation was meant to be sort of like a loose and raw conversation regarding the considerations that you should take into account when you're sizing ductwork, designing ductwork. And John did say that the 0.08 is a rule of thumb that will get you in the ballpark. So if you want to get the exact number you need for your friction rate, there's a method you got to go through to get that. And I believe the five-part series, the blog I brought up by Allison Bales, if you Google it, it sort of mentions that and how you come up with that number. So it's a very good read, guys. And thank you, John, once again, for getting on here and discussing ductwork and ductwork design. Happy HVACing.
Hope you enjoyed the show. Follow HVAC Know-It-All on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok, Twitter, LinkedIn, and anywhere else Gary feels like popping up. This has been a Two Smokes and a Coffee production.